You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this gray afternoon. Jim Shepherd's new book, Like You'd Understand Anyway, is a collection of 11 short stories. I hear you giggling. I like the way that you're able to say that. It's a collection of 11 short stories set in places from South Central Australia to ancient Greece, from outer space to summer camp. There are a variety of narrators. There's a Soviet nuclear scientist during the Chernobyl disaster, an executioner during the Reign of Terror, a Texas high school football player, and Aeschylus himself. The book is published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I'm delighted that it brings you, Jim Shepherd, to the Leonard Lopate Show today.
Well, I'm happy to be on it. Thanks.
Thank you so much. That range of narrators was one of the first things that struck me, is that each of these stories is in the first person, and each of those first person narrators have a distinctive voice, that the man you meet from Chernobyl has an entirely different voice from Aeschylus.
Boy, thank God. Wouldn't it be problematic otherwise?
Well, you wonder. Maybe Aeschylus spoke like a Soviet scientist. But I wondered how, as a writer, you get yourself into the head of this extraordinary array of characters.
I grew up in a huge Italian family, and part of the ways in which we did narrative, part of the ways we told ourselves stories was to do each other's voices. And so we would say things like, you know, so again, Auntie Ina says, you know, go take a poop for yourself or whatever. And we start throwing things around, you know, and we would figure out how to do everybody's voices as a way of being essentially entertaining. And I sort of extended that outward when I started to learn how to write and to sort of go, well, as I become interested in these worlds, which is also a way of enlarging my own sort of autobiographical arena of experiences. As I become interested in these worlds, I immerse myself in these voices as well. So if I'm, for example, thinking I might want to write about Aeschylus, I'm reading a lot of Aeschylus in various translations, and I'm reading a lot of everything I can to sort of imagine that kind of language. And when I'm finding something that starts to sound persuasive to me, I'm thinking that that's the way in which I inhabit the head. I inhabit the head first with the language, and then that voice starts to tell me certain things about the sort of emotional inner life, essentially.
That story starts, I am Aeschylus, and I imagined immediately a Greek hero,
right,
although he is not quite a Greek hero.
No, he's not. And in fact, part of the way a lot of my characters operate is they have an acute sense of the gap between what they think they should be and what they think they are. And if you're somebody like Aeschylus at Marathon, that gap becomes enormously momentous because you're about to be tested in a way that you're worried you're not going to succeed, essentially.
Many of the narrators in this book are adolescents, or they refer back to adolescent experience. And when I started that story about Aeschylus, he's talking about his brother, who is basically the person who has formed him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only on like page two or three that he says, my brother wrenched his ankle and is still suffering from it. We are not young men. I am 44 and he is 49. And all of a sudden my head spun because I thought, whoa, I was expecting from the animosity between these brothers that they were, you know, 19 and 23.
Right.
And instead they're men, he says, with families.
Yeah, alas, as you've probably figured out, it takes a lot to stamp the adolescent out of the male. And in fact, a lot of the males I know have that hidden 18-year-old inside them somewhere. And I think without that, a lot of our culture would make a lot less sense. So there's a way in which what I'm interested in is both actual adolescents, partially because they're in such an interestingly liminal position. You know, they're supposed to be responsible at a certain level, but they also have all of these things roiling around inside them that are pretty childish. And the way that that gets kind of frozen inside adult males, I think. And so it pops out at the most inopportune times, as most women will glumly tell you at one point or another. So I want that moment, which is sort of akin to the moment I had when I was reading about Aeschylus in the very early stages, and I realized, wait a minute. I mean, it's not agreed what his age was at Marathon, but it is agreed that he wasn't a young man. And, you know, part of what it meant to be a citizen soldier in Greece was that everybody fought of a certain class, and you fought until you couldn't carry a spear anymore. And so the idea that you'd be fighting at that age seemed to me quite poignant as well, because it's almost as if, you know, there's a volunteer football game and all of the 50-year-olds have to go out and play, and they know they're going to be facing 20-year-olds, you know, so there's a...
And unlike a football game, although it does happen in football, they know that they may die.
They know that they may die, yeah. And they know that this is part of why they've been training, and they know what they're doing this for. So then it becomes a matter of, am I going to, especially in a military formation like the phalanx, it's literally crucial that you hold up your end of the bargain, because if you don't, the person next to you will be in mortal danger. And so that sense you have of responsibility without adequate power, which I think is a sort of fundamental to male insecurity, couldn't be made more concrete. It's like, if you don't hold up your shield, I will be vulnerable, essentially.
We were talking about adolescence, and there is one story. There are a number of stories which are told from an adolescence perspective. I know you've said you were willing to read from one, which is about summer camp.
Which is about summer camp.
And much more than that.
I went to one of the great disastrous summer camps of all time, I thought. But I think there's a way in which everybody sort of cherishes these dismal memories and goes, nobody's ever experienced anything like this. And then when I read from that story, I have people come forward all the time and go, oh my God, my camp was so much worse than yours, you wouldn't believe it. And one of the things that happens when you walk through these kind of adolescent agonies, and one of the things that's wonderful about adolescence is the way everything is apocalyptic. You know, in seventh grade, you can't get your locker open, and that's the worst possible thing.
That
and
ruins the entire week.
It ruins the entire week. Yeah. And of course, adults can't understand it because they say, it's your locker. You know, this too will pass. But as soon as an adult says to an adolescent, you need to get some perspective on this, the adult proves to the adolescent that he or she doesn't understand the adolescent at all, because obviously perspective is what you need, but obviously perspective is what you don't have.
Entirely don't have.
It's all about this moment, and this moment is unbelievably intense. So I'm always coming up with stuff like this and reading it somewhere, and someone will go, oh, my God, I couldn't get my locker open, and I thought I was going to, you know, and I still remember how I didn't want to go back to school and things like that. So the summer camp story is a version of that, where you find yourself thinking, every single day is the worst day of my life, you know, and when is this going to stop and that kind of thing.
So can you tell us what happens leading up to where you're about to begin?
I'll read at the very beginning,
okay,
so
great.
I don't have to set anything
great.
Up. And then I'll just stop. Things will go from bad to worse, and then I'll just stop, and people can assume that something more interesting happens later in the story.
I'm speaking with Jim Shepherd about his new story collection, Like You'd Understand Anyway, that's just out from Knopf, and we're going to hear the beginning of
one story. This is the beginning of a story called Courtesy for Beginners. Summer camp. Here's how bad summer camp was. The day I arrived, I opened my camp trunk and changed my shirt and just stood there alone and breathing through my mouth in the four-man platform tent, just me and the canvas smell and the daddy long legs, and then I thought that I was the person who I least wanted to be with, and I stepped out into the cooler air. There was nowhere to unpack anything, and even I wasn't so scared that I could hang around in the tent. It was like 104. Sweat ran down the backs of my knees. The black metal stays on the tent ropes were too hot to touch. We were in a pine forest. Everything had that baked pine needle smell. My father had just driven away. A squirrel sat up across from me, woozy with the sun. He worked over a nut and then spit it at me. Way off behind him, two kids were sitting on another kid's chest in a clearing. Down the hill to my right, someone was ringing a bell. I headed down the path toward the noise. I think I was affecting a saunter. I sauntered down to the lean-to, where a few kids and some counselors were hanging out. A sign on top said, Counselors Lean-to. The counselors were two blonde guys, maybe 17 or 18, the kind of guys who seem like nice boys to moms. A fat kid who'd already taken off his shirt was bugging them about something. The fat kid had my glasses, which was too bad for the fat kid. They were even fixed with electrical tape on the same side that mine were. There was a whine in his voice that I could hear from up where I was, and he kept at it. You idiot, I thought, the whole time I was walking down to them. I was talking about me. I was always wanting myself to die whenever I found myself in a stupid situation. When I got to the front of the lean-to, I nodded at whoever caught my eye. Nobody nodded back. I told you I don't know, one of the blonde kids said, watching me fold my arms and stand there. He seemed to be talking to the fat kid. He had both hands on the 2x4 that was the top edge of the lean-to, and he was swinging his body a little, keeping his feet in place. He looked dangerously bored. The fat kid said something else. The blonde guy ignored him. The fat kid said something after that. The blonde guy swung with everything he had and brought his feet up together and caught the fat kid under the chin and up along his face. The fat kid left the ground a foot and a half and landed on his back. The sound was like when I whacked the sheet on our line with my wiffle bat. We all just stared like now we knew what we were in for the next however many weeks. I felt this rush like I was the blonde guy and the fat kid all at once. One of the other kids bent over and found where the glasses had landed. "How are you?" the guy who'd kicked the fat kid asked me. "I'm okay," I told him. I didn't know what else to say. "Come on, talk to me. Tell me what's wrong," my mother said when she got me alone the day before I left. I told her I didn't want to go to camp, and she said, "Besides the camp." I told her I guessed I felt bad about my brother, and she said, "Besides your brother." She was asking because she saw what I was like during the day and after school, and she wanted to help. She was worried that it would get even worse now that school was over. She said that everyone was worried that everything was taking too much of a toll. My grades had gone downhill. My friends had stopped coming around. Even the Venus flytrap in my room had died. She'd also found my list of the world's deadliest poisons. I was always ranking them and changing the rankings. I had a notebook with that title written inside on the first page that I kept in my desk. I looked in the encyclopedia and in the library and also under our sink. If it had a skull and crossbones on it, I checked it out.
That's from a story from, like, You'd Understand Anyway. It's Jim Shepherd's new collection. You know, as you read the first couple of paragraphs, I felt the familiar drop in the pit of my stomach of remembering those first days of camp. And knowing that story is a lot about camp and the terrors that you find there, but it's also about the terrors at home and the love that this boy has for his older brother who is finding demons of and fighting them of his own.
Yeah. In fact, the story unlocked for me when I had begun it and had sort of come to a halt because I thought, well, I just don't want to write about how bad camp is. That seems like a kind of banal subject. And it's a good example of how voice will lead you along as a writer because there was a moment when I was just letting the guy riff and he said, you know, but he's trying to cheer himself up and he's lying in his bunk and he says, but you know, this is no worse than home. And I thought, that's what the story is about. That's the story. And that's where, in fact, a voice can lead you, essentially. And then I suddenly realized that this wasn't about camp at all, that this was about, I wanted the reader to get to that point of going, oh my God, the camp is kind of vacation for him in some ways. And it's also about the sort of way in which some of us feel that we're in the lifeboat when it comes to family relations, and some of us feel like we're, you know, we've left behind other people in the water. And I've always had that vivid sense of people worrying about me more than they needed to be worrying about me while other people were in even more trouble. And that, of course, engages enormous empathy and guilt and all sorts of other things.
And that's so much the experience of being in a family.
Yeah, it is, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, you look around and you say, well, what about that person? You know, that person could use some help. So there's such a trade-off because, of course, you're narcissistic enough to want attention yourself and resent when you don't get it. But then you also think there may be other people who are in a lot more dire shape than I am.
And in some families, the one who doesn't get attention is the one who survives.
Yeah, often that's the case, given that, you know, there's that famous Woody Allen line, my parents never got divorced, although I begged them to. You know, just, you want to be left alone sometimes, you know.
The issue of brothers floats through this book. Aeschylus has a brother, has two brothers, actually. This narrator has a brother. The Soviet scientist in the beginning has two brothers for whom he is responsible and helpless.
Yeah.
You've dedicated this to your own brother. Mm-hmm. Where is that connection for you?
You know, brothers for me are a fascinating figure, fascinating sort of literary problem as well as a really fraught autobiographical thing. I mean, my brother, I have an older brother who was institutionalized when I was quite young, and institutionalized at a time when, you know, what I call a sort of dawn of science, essentially, when people were just figuring out pharmacological remedies and were just essentially testing people. And he had just an absolutely hideous experience. And he had a hideous experience at a time when I was, you know, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 years old. So I was very, I was very impressionable and very sort of knocked over by it. But it translates in literary terms, not only in terms of all of that emotion pouring into the story, but it also there's something strange about the position of brotherhood, especially in America, but I suppose more widely than that. There's this way in which, of course, it's an unconditional love. And of course, you want to be there for somebody. But there's also this model of masculine independence. So there isn't this sense of, well, you should always be doting on your brother and you should always be. So you're not, in fact, penalized socially for sort of saying, yeah, I haven't seen my brother in 4 years. I don't know what he's up to, right? Because the idea is, of course, you guys are free atoms. You're sort of bouncing around the universe. But there's always that sense of, when are you going to be there? When do you need to be there? How much should you demonstrate love for one another? Because there's also, of course, that masculine stoic thing where even in my generation, males will say, well, he knows how I feel about him. I don't have to say anything, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, in the story about Chernobyl, the eldest brother visits the younger brother in the hospital, mm-hmm. and the eldest brother is partially responsible, as is the younger right. brother, and the younger brother says, look, the investigator is weeping.
Yeah, exactly. There's a way in which the Chernobyl story is a really useful model for the way my stories often operate, which is the macro teaches you about the micro and vice versa, so that I will come to a story like the Chernobyl story, and I'll devour it in nonfiction terms, and I'll be enraged and fascinated by this whole notion of how could an apparatus overlook so much, and then the model will occur to me. It's very much the model of, you know, we all know that Uncle Billy is quite strange, and we all know that he has a terrible drinking problem, but we all look the other way because that makes things easier day to day, and then Uncle Billy's liver explodes, and we all say somebody should have done something, and the congruencies with something like Chernobyl were really overwhelming. And so setting up a family dynamic inside the Chernobyl chain of responsibility was just a natural thing to do, because that kind of willful blindness, that kind of nepotism, that kind of we all agree we're not going to face certain things just seemed beautifully apt for what I was dealing with.
One last question. A colleague gave one of the stories to her sons, the story about football, mm-hmm. which is quite a powerful story. And her 14-year-old son said, I hope that this gets turned into a novel because I want to find out what happens next. Many of your stories end with a lot of questions. Is mm-hmm. that something that you like to leave readers with?
It is. I mean, it seems to me that having a reader say, I really want to know more about these characters is not a bad thing. I get a lot of letters when I get letters at all, or emails. I get a lot of letters saying, whatever happened to X? Does it work out well? And a writer friend of mine, Charlie Baxter, once said that all your stories end in media res, essentially. You just stop things right about in the middle and you just let us know where this is sort of headed. And that seems to me a pretty good way of describing one of my strategies, which is to sort of enlarge your understanding in a fundamental way in the last couple gestures, but then to not say, here's the coda, here's how things settle down, here's how, as though these people, I mean, part of these stories, part of what I'm really interested in is the way these people have so much work still to do, and they have so much they still have to deal with, and I want to sort of dramatize that in some ways. I mean, I want to leave you feeling like, well, you better roll up your sleeves and do something because you have some problems, you know, or something like that.
You know, you said your readers often say, what happens next? Do you know and you just don't tell us? Or are you, like we, kind of wondering what is going to happen?
That's a good question. Sometimes, I mean, I think I could speculate, but I'm working so hard to try and create the illusion up to that moment in the story that I just feel this enormous relief that the burden's lifted
that
once that moment's over. Yeah, so I'm not worried what happens 32 years down the road or something. I'm now on to the next thing.
Well, you can find out about all of these characters in Jim Shepherd's new collection of short stories, Like You'd Understand Anyway. It's just out from Knopf. Thank you so much for
Thank
stopping
you.
By.